From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we'll get to the family separation policy in a moment with the governor of Washington State. But first, to the Supreme Court and a ruling today being celebrated by privacy advocates. The court decided that police cannot track you using your cell phone location data without a warrant. Dahlia Lithwick covers the courts for Slate. She hosts the podcast Amicus and joins us now. Hi, Dahlia.
Hey, Jeremy.
So this case was brought by a man named Timothy Carpenter, who was convicted of a number of robberies in the Detroit area. Tell us about the case, first of all.
Timothy Carpenter, you're going to love this. He was one of the things he was robbing was T-Mobile stores, and he was convicted, sentenced to 116 years. Over 127 days, the government got information tracking his exact location using what's called cell site location information, CSLI. And that's just every time your phone pings against a cell tower, that's the government scooping up that information. That's the cell company scooping up that information. And the government used it to convict him. And so what he said is, this is an invasion of my Fourth Amendment rights. This is an illegal search. And the question was whether we were going to broaden the scope of the Fourth Amendment to include data that you voluntarily give the phone company when you buy a phone.
And this was a 5-4 decision saying that that data cannot be gotten by police without a warrant. Justice Roberts wrote the opinion. What was his justification?
Well, he rooted it in the idea that even though you're giving this information away, and we know there's a whole 40 years worth of doctrine that says once you voluntarily give your information to the phone company, to the banks, to whoever, when you give that away, you have no privacy interest. The government can ask those entities for it. And John Roberts said, no, this isn't about voluntarily giving your information away, in some sense, because you can't have a phone without making that bargain. But much more pointedly, he says, this is tracking where you're going. It's not tracking phone numbers you've used or your information, your banking information. This is locational. And for John Roberts, that starts to intrude on really intimate things about your romantic life and who you associate with and where you pray. And he says that's a bridge too far. That feels to him akin to the case you may remember from 2014 where they said you can't search a cell phone without a warrant. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing in his view. Even though it's given to a third party, this is where you go. And for him, that's too much.
Now, interestingly, Roberts, who's a conservative, was siding with the four liberals on the court, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor and Kagan, which, by the way, this is not the first time this week that Justice Roberts has done that.
Yeah, this is an interesting line of cases. He has become a real, voice on the court for fear about creeping technological change and privacy. So he was actually the person who wrote the opinion saying it, Riley versus California, saying that you can't search cell phones without a warrant. He joined the opinion from a few years before that that said the government can't track you with a GPS device without a warrant. Mm-hmm. So he really, I think, has a deep sense. I don't know if it's that he's younger, although he's certainly not younger he's not younger than Gorsuch. So one would think it's not generational. But he does seem to have some sense, Jeremy, that creeping technological advances change the calculus and the framers could never have imagined what technology can do. And so for him, he jumps over and sides with the liberals time and again because he thinks privacy, if it means anything, it has to mean that the government can't find out where you are.
Dahlia, we've got about a week left of decisions from the court. What more are you waiting for?
Well, the big ones that are going to come next week, and they'll all come next week, are, of course, the travel ban, the Muslim ban, which will be, I think, the blockbuster decision of the term, but also the future of public sector unions and the funding of those unions, the Janus case, and Becerra, which is a case out of California that has to do with signs that crisis pregnancy centers had to post in the centers indicating what your actual reproductive rights are. So a couple of big, big cases to come.
Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts for Slate. She hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
President Trump's executive order ending his administration's practice of separating migrant children from their parents at the border did not end the fight against that policy. A group of states are still planning to sue the administration over it. Washington State is part of that group, and Democratic Governor Jay Inslee is on the line with us from Des Moines, Iowa. Governor Inslee, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about what this lawsuit says and what are you asking for?
Well, we're asking that the U.S. Constitution be followed and that the innate cruelty of the Trump administration be reined in by the judicial system. And it basically asks the courts to stop this pernicious process program of separating children from their families that was done intentionally to try to inflict injury and anxiety and fear in children and in families. And we're simply asking the court to apply the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution to this matter. And we need the courts to step in and protect us, because we know no matter what the situation is or what Donald Trump says, it's one tweet away from disaster and chaos. And we know these people can't run a two-car funeral, and so we need a judicial system to protect the Constitution.
Governor, if I may, so the president has signed his executive order that, at least on paper, says that families would be detained together. Is that not satisfactory?
No, and several reasons. Number one, the thing is so full of loopholes, you could drive a truck through it. It basically says we're only going to do it if I get the appropriations I want and if the policies I want, if it's legal. And it isn't. They can't do what they say they're going to do now legally, because there is already a judicial decision that it's illegal to indefinitely confine innocent children in a prison. And it's already a court decision.
Right. You're talking about the Flores dissent decree.
Correct.
They
blithely assume that they can just ignore the judicial system, which has been their arrogant attitude all the way through, number one.
Well, if I may, forgive me for interrupting, but there is a section of the executive order that directs the Attorney General to request the District Court of California to make modifications to that dissent decree so that they could hold families indefinitely.
Correct. But they've gone ahead with the policy without getting permission of the courts. So they basically willfully said, we're going to ignore the courts and just hope they'll come along later. That's number one. But number two, you need to understand that this executive order is essentially meaningless, because he can just change it tomorrow. There's no judicial or legal or statutory protection, and that's what we're doing.
Can I just jump in here?
We're leading the way.
Yeah. So there is a bill that the House is still struggling over. They've delayed a vote until next week, and this bill is the more moderate of the immigration proposals that have been on the table recently. It would include $25 billion for a border wall, a pathway to citizenship for undocumented young immigrants, and provisions for families to stay together in detention centers. We don't know if this bill is going to pass, but if it did, there would be a legal framework. Would you accept that?
No, because the courts have already ruled on this issue. And until the Supreme Court or some other court changes that, the president can't just ignore the law. And he's essentially saying he's going to do that. Now, I don't believe it's likely that we'll see that bill pass. Donald Trump himself torpedoed this through his sort of willful telling his own party not even to do this last week. And if you talk to anybody on the Hill, they'll tell you that this is one of the many times he has made it impossible for people to get anything done in the Capitol. And I just read a headline the other day that he's essentially told the Republicans to give up on this issue. So there's no meaningful way to actually protect these children. The reason they did this was to prevent families from having the ability to have even a hearing to determine if they're entitled to asylum. It is legal in this country to ask for asylum.
A couple more questions, if I may. Are there children who have been separated from their parents in Washington State now?
There are. There's at least nine that we have found, although they're not being held in anything that I think you would call sort of physically a callous environment. They are subject to what I would call emotional abuse and child abuse, because they're being separated from their parents. And I think anyone can understand that. I think that's why you've had such an outrage of because everyone understands what that bond is. It's the strongest bond, and it's the one that is most damaging when it's broken. So these children are being abused in my state right now, and I intend to do everything I can to get them fixed. And when they announce his policy and his executive order, you'll notice there's nothing in the order that pertains to these 2,000 children. They have no system of reuniting these people. They don't even know where they are, in effect.
Right. Can I just jump
in
here?
They haven't shared that.
Because I am seeing this report from Kevin Seif of the Washington Post, who talked to lawyers who were representing parents of some 400 kids trapped in this system. And he's reporting that Border Patrol agents forgot to note, in some cases, that a child crossed the border with their parent. So they're in the system as unaccompanied when they weren't. In other cases, children are transferred from one shelter to another, and the new facilities don't even note that the child was separated from the parent. I mean, so if there's so little information about these kids, and we're essentially relying on them to tell us who their parents are, how are we ever going to get them reunited?
This is a recurrent theme of cruelty and intolerance driven by a political desire to please his base. And that's really unfortunate that you would hold children hostages for political purposes. And that's exactly what's going on. It's pretty much unprecedented.
Well, that's Washington Governor Jay Inslee. Thank you so much, Governor.
Thank you. You bet.
You're listening to protesters shouting shame at embattled Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen this week while she was eating at a Mexican restaurant in Washington. Video of that protest was widely shared on social media. And this morning, protesters showed up outside Nielsen's home, blasting an audio recording of migrant children crying out for their mothers and fathers from a facility in Texas. More protests are planned across the country in the coming days as migrant parents and children separated at the border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy wait to be reunited. Joining us now is Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She's here to talk about how this and other news is playing out online this week. Femi,
hey,
it was great to have you here in the studio this week, but now back in your usual spot. Okay,
back
we miss
to
you
work.
Too. Well, tell us what other protests you're seeing pop up on social media over the family separations.
Oh, Jeremy, this really is a fierce battleground. Hashtag families belong. That's a huge march, June the 30th, coming to Washington, D.C., but there are sister marches all around the country. They haven't been cancelled because of the executive order, which came earlier on this week. People are still going to get out and march and say the way that the administration right now is looking at migrants, we should look at that again. Facebook fundraisers are also happening. A lot of the young children who are separated from their families and also migrants who need help from lawyers, all of that help is being done pro bono. There is one organization on Facebook which is called Reunite an Immigrant Parent with Their Child. In the last few days has raised $20 million. Hmm. And that's literally just to pay for legal fees.
Well, one of the images that has helped stoke the passion of protesters is one of a two-year-old girl crying at the border. It's also featured on the cover of Time magazine. But now, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders is tweeting that it is shameful that the media has been exploiting this photo of this little girl and that she was not separated from her mom. What's the story here?
Well, the photograph was taken by John Moore. It was shared by Getty. And he has explained in a number of places, including on NPR, the circumstances of the photograph. So it was a group of people were found by a border patrol. He took the picture as the mum had to put her little girl down. And the mum is called Sandra Sanchez. The little girl is called Yanela. And the fear and the separation anxiety, he caught that on camera. But he did say, I don't know what happened to them next. I have no idea. A lot of people now are looking online to see where they might be. And according to officials and foreign officials, the mum and the daughter are together. Mm-hmm. And that's about all we know at the moment.
It's amazing, though, how much just one image can tell a story that a lot of people get from what is going on here. There's another one, the New Yorker cover coming up is one that features the Statue of Liberty with children crouched below clutching to her robe.
And Jeremy, there's a couple of viral memes going around as well. Dijkstra Dam. I don't want you to also think that this is all coming from one side. Dijkstra Dam has a meme of former President Barack Obama. He is smiling. And then on the top of it, it says detained over 90,000 kids, ... No one cared, stamp liberal privilege. Hmm. So there are dueling memes going on. And this one, I think this is coming up quite a lot over the last couple of weeks. It's really a history refresher. Let's not act like separating kids from their parents is something that just started happening. Lots of pictures from history books of slavery where children and parents mm-hmm. were deliberately separated.
First Lady Melania Trump has caused a firestorm over a jacket that she wore on her way to visit a facility that's holding migrant children in Texas. Stephen Colbert mocked the jacket on his show last night.
Melania wore a jacket that says, "I really don't care, do you?"
Wow. Wow. Wow.
That's what they settled on? What was her first choice? A jacket that says, "Womp womp."
Colbert referencing there Corey Lewandowski, a former Trump advisor, saying womp womp on Fox News earlier this week while mocking a child with Down syndrome separated from her mom at the border. You know, at first people thought the photo of Melania Trump wearing the jacket yesterday was fake.
Hashtag not Photoshop.
But
it's not Photoshop. No, not at all. In fact, Stephanie Grisham, who is the spokeswoman for the First Lady, sent out a tweet to say, you know, we shouldn't be distracted by the jacket. You should really be looking at what Melania Trump was doing down on the border. Hashtag she cares. Hashtag it's just a jacket. That started another conversation. Mindy says, it's June and sweltering. She obviously didn't need a jacket. And then Stephanie Miller says, in Texas? Mm-hmm. So there's a whole conversation about why would the First Lady even be wearing a jacket, and also how distracting it was from her mission to actually draw attention to the children who've been separated at the border.
Yeah, this time of year, even in Minnesota, it would be kind of strange to wear a jacket. One other story we've been watching, Femi, New Zealand's prime minister has given birth to a healthy baby girl. She shared photos on Instagram and social media celebrating. How significant is it for a world leader to give birth while in office?
Well, this is the first time in about 30 years that a world leader has given birth in office. The last time was back in 1990 with the former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who gave birth to her baby back then. But New Zealanders are celebrating because they're saying this is gender equality, because the PM was working just a few hours before she gave birth and her partner will be a stay-at-home dad. So New Zealand is saying, hey, look at our PM. She's taking 6 weeks off, and then she's going to get straight back to work.
It's Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, also getting straight back to work after her stint here at Here and Now this week. Femi, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, now to a story that connects sports with medical research. Bobsledder Alana Myers-Taylor of Georgia won 3 medals, including silver, at this year's games in South Korea. But Taylor's Olympic career almost ended in 2015 after she suffered a serious concussion. Now she's pledging her brain to science to help doctors understand how concussions affect female athletes. Taylor Gant of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
Alana Myers-Taylor always wanted to be an Olympian for Team USA, but she wasn't always sure what sport was going to get her there. After a softball tryout didn't pan out, she got a suggestion for a different kind of sport.
My parents had actually seen bobsled on TV and were like, well, why don't you try this one? They look for strong, fast women. I said, sure, why not? And just Googled bobsled and found a coach's email, emailed them, and got invited to Lake Placid, New York for a tryout.
Needs to find some time, not much, just 400th of a second, and a possible goal.
That tryout led to a brilliant bobsledding career for Alana, which includes a bronze medal in Vancouver and a silver in Sochi. But a year after bringing home her second medal, Alana suffered a life-altering injury during a 2015 run in Germany.
My sled flipped, I hit my head on the ice, and that concussion changed basically a year of my life. I had symptoms for a while after that, and it really affected how I was able to not only perform in a bobsled, but my day-to-day living.
Alana experienced the normal symptoms of a concussion, headache, dizziness, fatigue. But long after the crash, she discovered that her mental state had taken a turn for the worse.
I became somebody completely different and was losing it on things that didn't even matter, things that didn't even make sense.
Alana turned to the doctors at the NeuroLife Institute to find a chiropractic solution to her problem. There she met Ryan Cedermark, who directs the Institute's Vital Health Life Center in Atlanta.
It's our open adjusting area, so we have 4 tables. So during the busy times, we kind of have all the tables going around, and patients just come in for...
Cedermark says athletes who suffer brain trauma often deal with damage to their balance centers, which can have physical and mental side effects.
If your balance is off and you're getting miscommunication from all these tissues in your feet, your legs, and your back, you're going to get some scrambled misinformation going into the brain.
The team at NeuroLife worked with Ilana to regain her mental balance with a number of exercises and tools, including a large rotating chair called the GyroStim, a device that almost looks like an astronaut training tool.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
So you're going upside down. So keep your head back and just trust your straps, is what I tell everybody.
With the center's help, Ilana finally began feeling like herself again. This spring, she earned her third Olympic medal at the Winter Games in South Korea. But last year, the overdose death of teammate Steve Holcomb got Ilana thinking about her legacy after sports.
For me, I really thought about my history with concussions and what I could do to help other people.
That's when she made the decision to donate her brain to the Concussion Legacy Foundation, a group that studies chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the brain disease associated with concussions.
We know very little about how concussions work in the female mind. So for me, leaving my brain specifically felt like I could do more for my legacy.
The world's largest CTE center, the Brain Bank at Boston University, says out of the hundreds of donated brains they've received, less than 10 are from female athletes. Donations like Ilana's could prove invaluable for shortening the research gap between men and women. Steve Brilio is director of the Neurotrauma Research Lab at the University of Michigan. He says more data on head injuries is key.
We don't have a strong understanding of what causes CTE, why some people get it, why some people don't. And I think a lot of research needs to focus in that area, and then we can start targeting those things that do result in the disease.
As for Ilana, her injury won't end her Olympic dream anytime soon. She plans on earning a fourth trip to the Winter Games in Beijing 4 years from now.
I absolutely love what I do. I'm healthy. I'm still young enough to compete at a very high level. So I want to give it another 4 years, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure I'm there in 2022.
Ilana says she'll take a few months to rest up from this year's games. But after that, it's right back in the sled. For Here and Now, I'm Taylor Gant in Atlanta.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
It's Here and Now. Representatives from some of the world's top oil-producing nations today lifted their 2016 production freeze, promising to bring down the global price of oil. Members of OPEC, or the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, agreed to increase of about 600,000 barrels per day. That's less than 1% of the current global supply. So what does that mean for consumers and the global economy? Well, let's ask Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hello there, Mike.
Hi, Meghna.
All right. So on paper, this is supposed to be an increase of around a million barrels a day. But analysts say in practice it'll be closer to 600,000. Why the difference?
Well, some members of OPEC actually are not able to increase production. Venezuela, for example, their economy and their oil industry is in such disarray that they won't really be able to boost production. And another one is Iran, that is under sanctions. So, you know, the goal would be a million barrel increase, but it'll probably end up being 600 or 700,000.
I see. So I guess the question that most people care about most immediately is, will it lead to lower gas prices at the pump?
Yeah. You know, anyone who took Economics 101 knows that bigger supply means lower prices. It's interesting today, you might not think that because oil actually jumped after the announcement. Crude oil is up almost 5% today. But that's because the market basically anticipated this and oil prices came down significantly from their highs in May. And if you look at even further out in the futures for delivery in at the end of the year, December, when these increases will really be, you know, in full force, that price has come down. It came down almost 10% or almost 11% really from its high in May. And now it's still down about 8%, even though it's back up today. So it definitely is some relief in prices from this deal, although you don't see it in today's action in the oil markets.
I see. Now, just how tight is the global crude oil supply? Because, I mean, this 600,000 to a million barrels per day, is that enough to make a big difference?
Well, supplies have definitely tightened up significantly. It's, we really went from a glut in oil just a few years ago to rather tight supplies now. Globally, oil inventories are at the lowest they've been in 3 years. So this is coming at the right time to sort of restock all those supplies.
Now, President Trump had called on OPEC to raise output, and it looks like he's going to get this. But how much did his pressure play a role in this?
Well, I don't think anyone in OPEC actually came out and admitted that they're sort of bowing to pressure from Trump. But there certainly has been a lot of speculation that it played a big role. Just as recently as late April, Saudi Arabia's energy minister had been signaling he wanted actually the production cuts to continue in order to boost prices higher. Saudi Arabia needs oil to be at about $88 a barrel to balance their budget. But then President Trump took to Twitter, as he does, and started targeting OPEC, and Saudi's energy minister basically did a U-turn.
Huh.
And that really increased the drama around all this. It opened him up for accusations from Iran and criticism that the Saudis were basically doing Trump's bidding.
Wow. Well, Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, happy Friday to you, and thanks as always.
You too. Thanks, Megan.
Summer is officially here, and if you want to escape the crowds at the beach, there are plenty of other places to go to take advantage of the nice weather and go exploring. Joining us now for some suggestions for where to go and what to do this summer is Tricia Ping, destination editor for Lonely Planet. Tricia, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy.
As somebody who works for Lonely Planet, do you just get to travel around and check all these places out for yourself?
I get to check a lot of places out for myself, yeah. It's pretty cool.
And you just got to hit, like, every restaurant in town to see which one is the best?
Well, it's a tough job, but no. Unfortunately, cannot hit every restaurant. But
right.
It's fun talking to people and, you know, hitting the highlights and just seeing what there is to see. There's so many, like, amazing experiences you can have in the USA.
And let's get to some of the ideas that you have for people who may want to do something a little different this summer. One of them, pretty surprising, North Georgia, you say, is a good place to visit.
Yeah, North Georgia is great. It offers a really wide range of activities, and there are some great summer festivals, and it's a really easy drive from Atlanta.
You know, I think I've actually been to North Georgia, driving up from Atlanta into the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina, but I didn't actually stop in North Georgia. So what's there exactly?
Well, there's some cute and quirky small towns. So Helen, Georgia is one of my favorites. It's a Germanic Alpine-style town that has just the right amount of kitsch and really quirky. You can also visit the site of the first U.S. gold rush, and that's in Dahlonega.
All right. Well, up further north, we've got another selection from you, the west coast of Michigan.
That's right. So Lake Michigan obviously has a lot of beautiful shoreline. It's a big vacation spot. But a little bit of a lesser known part of that shoreline is in western Michigan.
And what's there?
So it's a little more low-key. You can rent a cabin. You can enjoy some local food, small-town charm. There's sandy, dune-filled beaches. A couple of places that I really like, Ludington has a lovely small-town feel. There's access to Hamlin Lake and Ludington State Park, which has a lighthouse, a nature center, and, of course, miles of dunes. And one thing that Michigan has that's a quintessential summer activity is berry picking. Yeah, Michigan grows more fruit than any other state but California. So U-Pick sites are everywhere around the state, but there are several on the western coast of Lake Michigan.
All right. Well, you recommend Hudson Valley, New York, as another destination people may want to check out.
Yeah. So the Hudson Valley isn't really a new vacation spot. So the Hudson School of Painters have been, you know, talking about how beautiful this region is since the 1800s. But it's still... It's an easy escape from New York City, and it's a pretty relaxing, quiet place to visit.
One of the places that's on your list that sort of could be in any number of regions of the country, and a lot of people probably don't think that it would be a destination for them, is you say people should visit the Native American reservations and other cultural sites all over the U.S.
Yeah, so this is, like you say, it's a type of experience that can be found in a number of places around the U.S., but a lot of travelers might not consider this as a vacation or even realize that it's something they can do. So traveling through Native American communities and cultural sites should be done respectfully, but a lot of the communities really welcome and even rely on the tourist economy.
And you can do this, by the way. The Navajo Nation is in parts of Arizona, New Mexico, Utah. You can explore the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park. You can also visit Cherokee, North Carolina, and the Museum of the Cherokee Indian.
Yeah, so the Eastern USA, the original home to the Cherokee Indians, has several cultural sites that are important, including the Museum of the Cherokee Indian there. And you can also check out in the Eastern USA a lot of Native American mounds and ceremonial sites along the Natchez Trace Parkway, which is a gorgeous scenic drive that goes between Natchez, Mississippi and Nashville, Tennessee.
Hmm. One of the national parks on your list is the Wind Cave National Park, which is in South Dakota. That is not as busy, I'm assuming, as Mount Rushmore, but it's right there in South Dakota.
No, it's nowhere near as busy as Mount Rushmore, but it's only an hour away, and it's a much less touristed national park than, say, the Smokies or Grand Canyon or Yosemite.
And what makes it so great?
Well, the cave itself is just incredible. It's named for the strong gusts of wind you can feel at the entrance, and there's almost 150 miles of mapped passages that you can explore sections of. And in the summer, the park offers special candlelight tours of some of those lesser-known or lesser-toured passages. So if you want to double down on Off the Beaten Path, you can check that out.
All right. Your last domestic suggestion here is a place that we've heard is just booming and hopping right now, and that's Boise, Idaho.
Yeah. So Boise, it's just been popping up in a lot of discussions I've had about travel lately. It's got a great mix of outdoor adventure and a cultural scene. You can think of it as a kid sibling to Salt Lake City or Denver, maybe.
I've also heard that it's considered to be the new Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels to Portland there, too, for sure. They've got a big music festival downtown, Treefort Music Festival. They're calling it the new South by Southwest. Hmm. They've really revitalized their riverfront. There's a 25-mile park along the river, so you can participate in outdoor activities in the middle of the city if you want to.
That's something a lot of cities are doing now, smaller cities, is revitalizing their riverfronts.
Yeah, river or lake fronts, you know, in cities like Boise or Pittsburgh or Cleveland, you're really seeing a lot of revitalization of those formerly industrial spaces. Richmond also, the James River goes right through the city. It's a great outdoor spot.
Okay, let's get to just a couple of foreign destinations, one of which is in Mexico, is a place in Mexico that many may not have heard of, Guanajuato.
Yeah, so Guanajuato, you know, you think of Mexico, you might think of Cancun or even Mexico City, but we just love this city that features a unique culture. It's at a higher elevation, so it's a little bit cooler in the summer, so that's important. And the whole city is a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Hmm.
There's like colorful colonial architecture, cobbled alleyways you can wander through. And the history is pretty fascinating, too. It was the site of the first battle in the war for Mexican independence, so there's sites you can tour that are related to that. And it was also a big part of the Mexican silver boom, which started in the mid-1500s, and it's still an industry in Mexico today. You can visit the mines and kind of learn about that aspect of history.
And it's just northwest of Mexico City.
Yes.
One more place on your list, and this is a place that actually was in the news in the last year. It is an island in the Caribbean called Dominica. This is not the Dominican Republic. It's a separate country, actually, and they were affected by the hurricane.
Yeah, so Hurricane Maria really devastated Dominica, but they're bouncing back. And the thing that makes Dominica unique, you know, you think of the Caribbean, you think of white sand beaches, all-inclusive resorts, and you don't have that here. But what you do have is a hiker's paradise. If you like hiking, this needs to be on your bucket list. There's a slew of trails throughout the island and that will challenge even the most experienced hikers. The most popular one is 8 miles long, and it takes you to see the second largest boiling lake in the world.
What is a boiling lake?
It's like a hot spring, but it's a lake. It's pretty incredible.
Now, you would be going to Dominica if you traveled this summer during hurricane season, so you'd have to make sure that that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, I guess check the forecast. But right. If you're interested in helping Dominica rebuild, too, they have a volunteerism program going on, and they're encouraging people who come to the island to help them in the rebuilding efforts.
What is your favorite place that you've gone to in the last year?
Oh, that's so hard to choose. I guess right now, top of mind for me is New Orleans. I just had two pretty amazing trips there, and it's such a unique city. They're celebrating their 300th anniversary this year. It's just an amazing blend of cultures. The music scene is amazing. The food
scene is
top notch. Like, what's not to love about New Orleans?
I would have to put Quebec City on my list as I'd never been. Drove up, and it was fantastic. Beautiful little city.
I am dying to go there. I'm a big Francophile, so I need to go see the French-speaking places in my own backyard.
Well, you may not be able to understand them because their French is a little bit different, but still lovely nonetheless. That's Tricia Ping, who is destination editor for Lonely Planet. Tricia, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's been a lot of fun.
In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will find out on Sunday if his gamble paid off. Erdogan scheduled the next election more than a year ahead of schedule in a bid to consolidate his power and earn another 5-year term. Security will be tight. Authorities say they arrested a number of Islamic State fighters who were planning to attack the election. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul. And Mark, what's at stake this election on Sunday?
What's at stake, some would say, Meghna, would be the actual fate of Turkish democracy itself. That is certainly, critics of President Erdogan would say that, because if he wins this election, he will amass sweeping new powers that would subjugate parliament, that would give him the right to rule with decrees. He would scrap the post of prime minister, so he would not only be the head of state, but also the head of the executive. He would be able to choose most ministers and senior judges. So, really, it would be, in a sense, absolute power for him. His supporters say that is not the case, that Parliament will still have a right to launch investigations on against him or against the President, possibly even impeach if there was a big majority in voting in favour, that a presidential system here, which is what he wants, is a way of streamlining Turkish political decision-making and making it a more effective country. So that is really the in terms of the powers. In terms of what's the other major thing that is at stake, it is really whether or not Turkey continues under President Erdogan. He has been the dominant political force here for 15 years, but he is facing the fight of his political life as an opposition unites for the parliamentary election and as he faces a very strong challenger in the presidential election, making it possible, just possible, that we will be talking about the potential end of the Erdogan era after this.
Okay, interesting. Now, as we noted, though, he scheduled the election a year ahead of schedule. You know, I guess he sees that this is his opportunity to consolidate that power. But you said that he has a very popular opponent. Who is his opponent?
This is Muharrem İnce, who is a centre-left secularist from the CHP party, the Republican People's Party, main opposition here, who is a long-standing MP with the party, but he was not particularly well-known outside the country until he announced his candidacy about 5 weeks ago. And he has absolutely burst onto the scene here, seizing momentum, drawing huge crowds with a combination of an image of being a man of the people, but also a real firebrand speaker. He's used a range of props in rallies, whipping out a milk bottle to talk about rising food prices, mocking President Erdogan's low ratings in a TV interview, saying that even the weather forecast has a larger share of the audience. He's used a combination of wit, charisma, kind of popular touch to present himself as a really, really strong challenger. So Erdogan has met his match in Muharrem İnce. The question is whether İnce can really unite a very fractured opposition around his candidacy if it goes to a second round runoff with President Erdogan.
Now, just to remind people, there was an attempted coup against Erdogan in 2016. It failed. It was put down. How does that very near history reflect upon this moment here?
It's absolutely everywhere, not least in the state of emergency that was declared after the failed coup and has remained ever since, making this the first election in Turkish history under a state of emergency. It means that the right of assembly is limited. It means that there are sweeping powers from the government to be able to arrest and detain people. There have been a lot of observers from the pro-Kurdish party, the HDP, which is an opposition party opposing President Erdogan, who have been detained in recent days. And really, there is, you know, there are constant references to the failed coup, to the Islamic network that the government blames for it, and the government uses that charge quite often to hit out at its political opponents in the campaign, blaming the, you know, accusing them of being part of that coup supporting network. So really, it is still, yes, it was 2 years ago, but it is still absolutely in the minds of people as we approach this vote.
And final question, Mark. I imagine that the world is watching this election very carefully, given Turkey's critical importance in the region and its strategic importance as well.
Yeah, that is a point that is really worth reinstating, that this is an election that matters far beyond Turkey's borders. This is a hugely pivotal country. It has got the second largest army in NATO after the US. It is still a candidate for membership of the European Union, although that seems further away than ever. It plays a pivotal role, a crucial role in neighboring Syria and Iraq and in stopping the migrant crisis. There are few countries in the world that you can think of that are as at the center of kind of a range of world affairs like Turkey. It is, you know, important in relations with Russia, relations with the Gulf, the Middle East. I mean, it was traditionally the anchor of stability in this region. It has very much changed in the last few years with terror attacks and with a turn towards authoritarianism, but it is still a close Western ally, and that is why really everybody around the world will be watching this election very closely. Does President Erdogan, is his power cemented, or does a new leader come in to steer Turkey's ship and change its direction in a very radical way?
Well, that's the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us from Istanbul. Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Of course, we'll be talking about the results of Turkey's election on Monday. This is Here and Now.